Welcome aboard. We will be your guides during this magical journey into the movies. It's the perfect job for us because we love the movies. It's showtime. Ready when you are, CB.
Action.
Welcome to Monorail Radio, episode number 275. I'm Sean.
And I'm Jackie.
And we are here this week to review and discuss Splash. It's a little opportunistic for us to finally sit and discuss this film because it is celebrating its 40th anniversary, which makes me feel old because I remember when this movie was still kind of new. But 275 episodes in, into proper reviews of Disney films, and for the most part, we've stuck to Disney or Marvel Studios or Lucasfilm post-acquisition, you know, after Disney got their hands on it. We've done one Touchstone film in the past, and that was Who Framed Roger Rabbit, way back in the early days of Monorail Radio. But we knew that eventually Buena Vista Pictures and Touchstone were going to weave their way in. I think celebrating the 40th anniversary of Splash is the way to do it because it's also the 40th anniversary of Touchstone.
Right.
I did not remember that this was the one that got it all started for them. This was their way, you know, when Michael Eisner and Frank Wells came in, that they were trying to branch out and reach that tween and early adult, young adult demographic, and they launched movies like this. They wanted Touchstone to kind of be the jumping off point to kind of help rehabilitate a lot of the financial issues that Disney was having at the time.
Definitely. It's interesting that you use the word opportunistic because when I knew that we were going into this one, the word that came to mind for me was bittersweet because I'm thinking in terms of this was really the jumping off point, especially because this film was a box office success for the Disney animators to be kicked off the lot. And that's where I kind of felt we were going to wrestle with this one a little bit because obviously it was very wrong that they got kicked off. Those animators, along with Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, are really what saved this company. I will give this film credit, though, for keeping it afloat because when this was released, it was the same week that Roy Disney resigned. And these box office numbers are what gave the company a little bit of a boost that they were actually expecting to get from the opening of Epcot 3 years earlier.
Yeah, because Epcot was not doing well in its first few years. And I mean, I think anytime you do a big venture like that and you put so much capital into it that it, like, it's going to take a long time to kind of recuperate all of that. And obviously, Walt Disney World at the time is not what it is today.
Of course.
Right? Epcot was only the second park at the time.
But the question becomes, does this roll of the dice pay off? Did they make a good movie?
Well, yes. Did they make a good film? Was this the right move to kind of branch off into this style of filmmaking, this style of storytelling? And is the film timeless, right? 40 years later. That, on top of many other things, is what we are here to discuss today.
This episode is sponsored by Fierce Fox Co., designers of handmade silkscreen shirts. Fierce Fox has a t-shirt, tank top, hoodie, or crew neck for every fandom. So whether it's the movies or theme parks, princesses or villains, the MCU or Star Wars, everyone will find something they love. The designs range from subtle quotes from our favorite films to iconic characters we can wear proudly in so many different styles, such as sketchbook and concert tees. Listeners of Monorail Radio can get a 20% discount using the code Monorail at checkout. Visit fiercefoxco.com to check out all of the collections.
On Cape Cod, a young Alan Bauer is taking a boat tour with his family when he jumps overboard to get a better look at something that he sees in the water. It turns out to be a young mermaid, but Alan is rescued before they can share a word. Excuse me. 20 years later, Alan has assumed control over their family's wholesale fruit distribution company following the death of their father. Alan struggles with the bad business deals made by his brother Freddie, as well as a recent breakup with his girlfriend Victoria. Following a friend's wedding, Alan gets drunk and takes a cab from New York City to Cape Cod. Alan gets dropped off on the wrong side of the Cape and meets Dr. Walter Kornbluth, a marine biologist who believes that Alan is there to spy on his research and casts him off. Alan, who can't swim, hitches a ride on a small dinghy, but the skipper accidentally floods the engine and leaves to get his other boat. Alan becomes frustrated and accidentally gets thrown from the boat when he gets the engine to start. He is struck in the head by the hull of the boat and knocked out before being rescued by a mystery woman who kisses him before diving back into the water and disappearing. She retrieves Alan's wallet from the ocean floor and leaves for New York to return it, but not before being found by Kornbluth. In New York, the mermaid is apprehended by the Statue of Liberty. She is naked, having come out of the water. However, the police call Alan to pick her up after they find his wallet on her person. Alan retrieves her from the police station, but has problems communicating with her as she does not appear to speak English. She is, however, very intimate with him at every turn. Alan leaves her in his apartment with the television on so he can go back to work. The television teaches her to speak, and she goes to Bloomingdale's to buy some clothes. Needing to give her a name to call her, she chooses the name Madison after Madison Avenue. She also tells Alan that she can only stay for 6 days until the moon is full, otherwise she can never go back, and all of this is very confusing to Alan. On Cape Cod, Kornbluth sees Madison's nude picture from New York on the front page of the paper and leaves to track her down. Freddie gets the pair invited to a political event where the President of the United States will be speaking, as he sees it as a networking opportunity. Kornbluth, meanwhile, continues to pursue Madison while hurting his reputation, as no one truly believes that a mermaid exists. Madison also trades her necklace for a mermaid fountain that they saw in the park as a gift for Alan, and they tell each other that they love each other. Kornbluth becomes obsessed with the idea of soaking Madison to have her legs turn back into a fin, and fails at every turn. Alan, believing Madison must leave due to immigration laws, suggests that she marries him to stay in the country. However, she tells him no and refuses to reveal her secret to him, causing him to give her the cold shoulder. After a tension-filled ice skating date, Madison runs off to be alone. Eventually, they reunite, and Madison agrees to marry him, but wants to tell him her secret first, but Alan's excitement continues to interrupt her. They attend the political event where Kornbluth arrives, and eventually sprays Madison with water, exposing her fin. She is taken by scientists to be studied and begins to deteriorate inside of her tank. Kornbluth becomes alarmed when it is suggested that Madison will be opened up to be studied. While initially furious, Alan comes back to normal and tracks down Kornbluth, who offers to take Alan to see Madison. He tells the military guards who are watching over her that Alan and Freddy are Swedish doctors who have come early to examine the mermaid. They break free with Madison and are pursued by the authorities. They reach the water, where Madison tells Alan that he can go with her to the ocean. However, if he goes, he can never return. Alan lets her go to save her. However, after the authorities continue to pursue her, he dives in after her. Still unable to swim, she kisses him, which allows him to breathe under the surface. They fight off the authorities, and they swim off together. So, this movie starts on a flashback. It is a very quick black and white flashback.
The use of the song is fantastic, though.
It is. I love how they open the film. I love the quick backstory. I think it tells us everything that we need to see. I love the costume. I love, like you said, the song. I love that it's in black and white. Like, the whole thing just works.
It does. And what's wild is that I had forgotten all about this. We didn't really talk about it in our show open, our history with this film. I think I've only seen it once, so this was not one of the most memorable scenes for me. But it does do a lot of good things. There's a lot of really good setup here. Like I said, catchy song. I like Wooly Bully over the credits, but I think it's really great how they transition it to the band on the boat. As cheap as it is, Freddie's intro may be one of the greatest character intros of all time. And this is where I don't know if it's just me. I get totally distracted by things like this, because I was like, where did this story come from? Because you have to assume that one of the writers, one of the producers, maybe even Ron Howard, the director, had done something like this where they inserted it into the film as a character moment. And then I started spiraling and I was like, really, Ron Howard? Gross. Come on. But for Freddy, it's so great because when we jump forward in time and we see him again as an adult, they double down on everything. He comes in, literally crashes his car. He's talking about making a deal for their business on a poker bet. He's got the Penthouse magazine. So it's a really great setup for this character. And, you know, obviously we're going to talk about the cast later, but John Candy does so much to develop him in such a short time.
Yeah, that character, that intro, I'd go so far as to say his intro was probably better than Madison and Alan's intros.
Hands down.
I
Fins down. Fins up.
Yeah, all of it. But yeah, the Penthouse magazine thing, that definitely took me by surprise.
Which, by the way, if you're watching with kids, I think we should talk about this up top. Obviously, there is nudity. Disney actually has it in the top left as brief nudity. I'm going to disagree. I don't think there's, I mean, they're not like holding shots for very long, but they're holding them a little bit. The cover of the Penthouse is blurred out, though. You can still kind of tell what it is.
I mean, the movie has a PG rating. So,
which is surprising, I think.
I don't think it is.
For brief nudity? Like, Jumanji also has a PG rating, you know? Like, if you compare the two.
I mean, you see Daryl Hannah's rear end twice.
A little side boob, little under boob.
But I think that that's all very tame. Compared to today's standards, you see that on network television. You see that at every award show.
That's true.
It's tame now.
That is true. But for those who aren't familiar with the movie, if you are going to put it on with a young child, I just want to sort of put it out there to, you know, be prepared. Like, this is not another Little Mermaid story. I think actually that's an interesting point too, is that this was Little Mermaid's predecessor. Because you would think if Disney's trying to do these cash grabs by doing live action films, they would have capitalized on the success of The Little Mermaid by making it, like, you know, this could have been the first live action Little Mermaid, but it was actually 5 years before.
Well, I think the first 5 minutes of the movie is incredibly well paced. I love the cast chemistry, specifically with Tom Hanks and John Candy. And they had done a few films together over the course of their careers. Volunteers, they did that film together. But I felt like the cast was totally believable. I love how Tom Hanks, Alan, is interacting with everybody in the market and, you know, dealing with angry customers and give them bananas at cost and make them happy. Like, the whole thing just feels very natural. I don't buy for a second that I'm watching Tom Hanks play a role. I'm buying that Tom Hanks runs this company.
I would agree. I think it's also really well written, because when he does finally get a breather and they go up to their office, they have this quick beat with the secretary where she's giving them messages and she says that their father called. And Alan says he's been dead for years. This is such an example of great writing. Because now we've exposed that their dad, who's responsible for all of these nice vacations that they have such fond memories of, is gone. These two are on their own to handle the business, which you could tell. But I love that we got it here and they played it for comedy instead of getting them to the office and having Alan, well, you know, if dad was here,
yes,
it's, you know, just so obvious to do it that way. So I thought that was really well done. The other thing that I bump on through this whole open, good riddance, Victoria. Like, what do you expect when you're calling him at work and he's got all these people breathing down his neck? Like, this was not the time to have this conversation.
I'm glad that you bring that up, because I don't disagree with you that she's having that conversation at the wrong time. However, you have a character here, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, who's being set up. He was Ted Mosby before there was Ted Mosby.
Absolutely.
Okay. He's desperate. He wants to fall in love. He wants to marry the girl. He wants to have the family. He wants to this. He wants to that. And I understand that he doesn't truly love Victoria, But when she asks him flat out, do you love me?
Oh, he fumbled the bag.
Well, not only did he fumble the bag, but he almost did it. It's almost a little narcissistic. He's like, well, you moved in, didn't you?
Yeah, haven't I done enough?
Yeah. He's like, well, don't you love me?
It's not the same thing.
It's not the same thing. So, like, and later on at the wedding, where's Victoria? Where's Victoria? And, like, he keeps getting a little bit more aggravated and a little bit more aggravated. It's fun. It plays for comedy very well. But what it tells me is that they've kind of been together for a while. They seemingly had a good thing going. It seemed like everybody that knew him liked her. And I start to question, like, did you ruin a good thing because you didn't really want to commit? Because he has that moment later on with Madison, too, where it seems like he doesn't want to commit to anything.
But you got to respect that about him, because if he doesn't truly love her, then why go through with getting married and just say, you know, hey, this all looks great on paper. I mean, tons of people do it. I don't want to end up alone, and you get married and you don't truly love each other. And that's, you know, very problematic. But I kind of like that it all comes to a head here. And as predictable as, you know, them ushering the wedding guests in and that moment where he just kind of explodes, you saw it coming a mile away, but they just deliver on it because it's acted out so well. It's really well done. And to your point, the chemistry between these two, the brothers, you know, it's just building, building, building with the comedy. But I also love the yin and the yang of, you have the brother that wants the commitment, that sort of had it and blew the opportunity, and the other one that wants nothing to do with it.
Right. Who's been divorced how many times? As he said, you brought a date to your last wedding.
Yeah.
Really, really good. Really good writing. But yeah, then after the wedding, you get the moment where they're drunk in the bar and Alan snaps at every couple and then decides he's going to go to Cape Cod because he likes Cape Cod, because he's got happy memories in Cape Cod. And obviously, we know that he's drawn to Cape Cod. He doesn't know why he's drawn to Cape Cod, but we know that he's drawn for the mermaid, right?
This is where that intro is also so important, that he didn't just go on a whim and see the mermaid as an adult. I like that he was called back there. But even mermaid aside, you know, they don't have their parents anymore. That's why he's so drawn to it. That's when he was happy.
But 300 miles, you'd have to be intoxicated to get in a New York City checkered cab and pay the fare for a 300-mile drive to Cape Cod. Think about what it takes to get an Uber to the airport for 40 minutes is $120.
I can't even imagine. Even with 80s pricing, it would have been astronomical, this cab fare. But I also like the subtlety in that they're sort of setting up that the brothers are successful. They haven't squandered the family business, even though Freddie's talking about, you know, gambling and making all of these dirty deals. And obviously, you know, we're going to see later that Alan has a nice apartment in, you know, a well-to-do area of New York. So it's all established in the setting, really. But, you know, this is a more subtle way of doing it because he really doesn't care. Forget that he's drunk. He's not going to be sweating this bill after the fact.
So we get to Cape Cod. Alan's dropped on the wrong side of the island and he meets Cornbluth, played by Eugene Levy. And we'll talk about the cast later on, you know, in depth. But I like the introduction to Cornbluth. I think he's funny. I think it's odd that he has this man who clearly is hungover in a tuxedo, stumbling on the beach, and his immediate thought is not, oh, this is some drunken idiot stumbling out of a wedding. This is another scientist that's here to spy on my research.
Tells you everything that you need to know about this character. We will talk about cast later, but I just have to say in this scene, like, how much it strikes me. Because, you know, I really didn't watch a lot of early Eugene Levy stuff, but it just is striking how much he looks like his son.
Yeah.
We're huge Schitt's Creek fans. But I was just like, I had to double take and I was like, wait a second. yeah, that one threw me. The only thing I bump on in this scene, I mean, you know he's going to get rescued, right? Like, this is totally Ariel rescuing Prince Eric in reverse. I'll buy the wallet dropping, you know, because she's got to figure out how to get to Manhattan, that he's not local to Cape Cod. But how does she know how to read the license and the map? Like, we do, they sort of pay off on it later when she learns to speak. So, okay, fine. I'll buy the notion that she's extremely intelligent and she's going to soak everything up like a sponge. But the reading, how?
I'll buy it. I'll buy that she knows how to read because she seems to be a quick learner. And she is very much like Ariel, right? She's got her little trinkets. She's got her map in the sunken ship. So if that's like what she does, if that's her thing, and then, you know, we later see where she lives by the end of the film, I would believe that this is a character who can read. What stood out to me more than anything else was when they go up on that beach, first off, it's a decent meet cute for a rom-com.
Yeah.
I'm looking at that water. I'm looking at that beach and I go, this isn't Cape Cod.
No, it's the Bahamas.
Yes. Gordo Key is where that scene was shot. And Disney must have really liked Gordo Key, because in 1997, they signed a 99-year lease with the Bahamian government and renamed it Castaway Key.
No kidding. So this is how they did it. I mean, every major cruise line does have their own quote unquote private island where you go for the day so that you keep spending the money with them and not, you know, in another port. So that was no mystery that DCL had an island, but that is so interesting and so cool that they were able to repurpose it. All right, now we really have no more excuses to not go on a Disney cruise. We have to go to the filming location of Splash.
I mean, is it a write-off? Again, just quote Schitt's Creek. Is it a write-off?
Write it off.
Because now it's research. It's a film set.
By who? The write-off people.
The write-off people.
This is not legal advice from Monoreal Radio. I am glad that you bring up the filming location, though, because this whole sequence is just so beautifully shot. I mean, you can tell from the coral that they're not even in California. Obviously, you know, the studios are in Burbank. You could have assumed they were going to do all of the beach stuff in Malibu, but I think, you know, depending on when this was filmed, they're going to want to take them where it's warm. And obviously, I mean, you're doing a mermaid movie. You bothered to create this beautiful costume for Daryl Hannah and, you know, these really elegant tropical looking fins. You have to have the setting to match. But I love the way this was all shot. You know, you need the coral to give it that pop of color.
Yeah. Now, if they did that movie today, it would be CGI. I can say that in confidence because we just had the live action Little Mermaid, which is different. They're going to, you know, they're talking and singing underwater. So very different. However, this movie looks great.
It really
looks
does.
Spectacular. I love the set. The prosthetic is incredible. The prosthetic fin that they put on her. I can't imagine how much time she had to spend under that water. She is underwater for long periods of time in multiple scenes in this film. It had to be a grueling task for her to film this.
And this was one of her first movies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, with that in mind, she's probably going to be like, yeah, sure, whatever. I'm down to do it because, you know, she appreciates the opportunity. But like, that's a lot to take on for someone who's not a seasoned actress.
Yeah. So now she has the wallet. She swims back to New York, right? Alan is already back in New York. He's been away for the weekend. He's got the big bandage on his head. And here she comes out of the water on land at the Statue of Liberty. And the police officer looks at her with no clothes on and goes, hey, this isn't California.
I love that dig. I think that that's probably...
I mean, it is now. New York and California are basically the same thing now.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I feel like this is, if anything, where the film feels really dated, because there used to be like almost a rivalry of like which was the better city. So the dig didn't necessarily feel out of place at the time, but I feel like people now are not necessarily going to get it. Another reference that feels very dated. Freddie has crafted this whole story to make a deal that Alan is a Vietnam veteran. And I feel like the general attitude about Vietnam, it was terrible at the time because our veterans weren't recognized. And I feel like that's sort of gotten better as time has progressed. Not, it's not great the way that the veterans are honored for it, but it's gotten a little bit better. But the way they just use it to roll with this head injury, I mean, Alan walked right into this because he got, you know, he bumped it on the boat, but now it just fits this crazy Freddy narrative.
Yeah, and if you think about it, you know, just for reference, Vietnam in 1984 would be like if we were talking about veterans in the Afghan and Iraqi war now, you know, like it would, you couldn't even reference the Gulf. It was that, even that at this point is too far. So that's kind of the time period. You know, so yeah, I think that's obviously a reference that could only have made sense at the time. And that was only going to date the movie a little bit. But for the most part, I feel like the movie, I don't think the movie feels dated too much more after instances like this. There are just certain areas, like I said, where you can't help but reference the period of time.
Right.
So the police call Alan because they find the wallet on her. He doesn't know who she is. There's one thing that after a couple of viewings, and I had seen this movie not a ton, a couple of times previous to sitting to record the episode here. The very aggressive, listen, it's a PG film. It's not that bad. But like the very aggressive intimacy, her to him, I couldn't remember like if there's a clear payoff on that as to why she's so aggressive with him all of the time. They don't ever really pay off on it.
They don't, but in a way, I don't care because the chemistry is so great.
Yeah, that's true. They do have great chemistry. I just thought, like, they planted it early on that they saw each other as kids. I guess that we're to assume that there's a mutual infatuation between the two of them.
I kind of feel like she is the aggressor, and I think that that's because she doesn't know any better. You know, let's not forget, we're in Alan's POV. You know, this isn't like The Little Mermaid where we know Ariel's POV. It's very clear. She wants to be on land with the humans. She has studied them. We have no idea, you know, what Madison's knowledge of the human world is. For all we know, her very limited look at the human world could be that people are vacationing in Cape Cod and they're making out because they're on vacation, you know?
Right.
If that's all she's seen, that's all she's going to know to do. And if all she has are these feelings for Alan, she's not going to know the difference between, you know, should I act on them? Should I not? Should I hold back? Like, she's just going to, she's just going for it.
Yeah. I love that he leaves her in the house or in the apartment. He goes back to work to go take a nap. He's not even going there to work. He's singing Zippity Doo-Dah and he's having a blast of it.
That was a nice little Easter egg there.
And she goes to Bloomingdale's because she sees it on television and she's learning everything through television. The sales rep at Bloomingdale's should have her own reality television show.
Really?
There's something about her that like, 9 times out of 10, this character would drive me crazy, but there's something about her that I find her endearing. I find her funny. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is about this one character. Like I said, I feel like if I met her in person, I wouldn't want anything to do with her, but there's something about her in this film. And I think maybe it's because Madison is so damn charming that you kind of see them do the Pretty Woman thing before Pretty Woman, which was another touchstone, which we're eventually going to talk about on this show, by the way.
Actually, I think that has an anniversary coming up, too.
I think in the next year or two. I think.
Might be this one. We'll see.
Well, anyway, I don't know. There's just something about their interaction that I really like.
Wow. Okay. Lots to unpack here. To me, you want to talk about opportunistic. I think that that's all she sees is dollar signs when she looks at Madison. You know, she sees her like a model. And if this woman's working on commission, I can see where she wants to, you know, quote unquote, help her. She wants to dress her up. Right. She wants her spending money. To me, my biggest issue with her is that she says, my daughter's anorexic. She's so lucky. That is where the film, nom joke aside, this is where the film feels the most dated to me, because this is back in the time of, it wasn't quite the 90s yet where you had those like heroin chic models that were super skinny. It was, this even preceded Kate Moss, I believe it was, that said nothing tastes as good as skinny feels, which we can never forgive her for. The only reason that she gets a pass is because she went to bat for Johnny Depp. But even still, I'm not sure that I fully forgive her for that. But anyway, this was the attitude at the time. Women were obsessed with being, you know, not just thin, not fit, not healthy, skinny. So this was sort of how they viewed it. It's not funny to make a joke about an eating disorder, but this was very much the norm of the time. I hate to say it.
But are they picking fun at the norm? Because they knew that at the time it was ridiculous.
No, I don't think so, because there's nothing really funny about the line. She's serious. That's the problem.
She's serious if you take her seriously, though.
Well, I guess that's my other issue, is like, you know, personal feelings aside, it's story structure here now. You have the literal fish out of water story that you could be playing for comedy, especially that you've landed her in Manhattan. The way they do perfectly with Giselle in Enchanted.
Yeah.
But you don't have Madison, you know, picking things up that she's never seen that are inappropriate, or like eating things that maybe she shouldn't, you know, like that's where you usually get all the comedy from in a situation like this. The only time that they really do it is that she's been sitting in front of a TV all day. So when she goes out with Alan later and they're talking about like getting to know each other, she's like, okay, answer the questions, win great prizes. And that's like the most comedy that you get. And I feel like it sort of falls flat. I feel like there was a lot more that they could have done with this.
All right. So I'm surprised that that's how you feel about it. Because first off, seeing Crazy Eddie, that was fun. Because I remember he was everywhere. Very regional to New York.
I was going to say that was a local thing, right?
Yep. Syosset, Westbury. We shopped in those stores for Crazy Eddie. But It was fun to see him again. But from the store to the street, I thought that Daryl Hannah was the perfect balance of whimsy and innocent. I liked her reciting the game show lines because it was the only thing that she knew to do. I liked that was how she learned how to communicate. I thought that it was funny. You know, when Alan asks her, how long are you here for? And she's like, 6 fun-filled days, because she doesn't know how else to explain it.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny, and I thought that it did work.
I mean, I guess it's just sort of surprising that this role is so physically demanding because she's swimming. They didn't go for more physical comedy. I mean, the easy crutch would have been, okay, she's got legs for the first time. Like, I'm glad that they didn't waste time, like, you know, having her wobble all over the place. But, you know, we were just talking about the build leading up to this, that why is she being so aggressive? Why is she, you know, kissing him? We've established she doesn't know any better. She doesn't know what to do. I feel like there just could have been a lot more missteps that would have been really funny.
Now, as their relationship starts to develop, this is the one obviously between Alan and Madison. Let's talk about that for a second, actually, where he says, I've got to call you something. I need to give you a name. And he starts rattling off just regular name, Jane, Susie, Jennifer, you know? And then he looks up and he's giving himself directions out loud. And he goes like, oh, we're on Madison. And she wants to be referred to as Madison. And he goes, well, Madison's not really a name. After this movie came out, the name Madison,
the boom,
became a huge, huge name.
I can imagine. And that's, you know, it's so interesting and so sad at the same time, is that we're not really going to have cultural touchstones like this. Anyway, oh, touchstone, pun not intended there. You're never going to really have that anymore. Unless it's a movie, you know, like we did have a phenomenon last year with Barbie and Oppenheimer, but unless it's something like that, where you do draw the mass attention of the public, you know, everything is so spread out otherwise. Everything is sort of niche. Everything is sort of, if you know, you know. I feel like we're not going to have these sort of cultural phenomenons anymore.
Well, more on that later. I'm putting a pin in that because it kind of is going to go hand in hand with our news of the week. So I want to put a pin in that.
Okay. I do think, though, this is where, to your point, I like Madison's innocence, and I feel like they lean into that quite a bit and they utilize it well. And I feel like that's sort of the trade-off for them not doing physical comedy, because you're focusing more on this rom-com aspect of it and her experiencing all of these other firsts, like just, you know, having a name, or, you know, later on they go on their date and they're skating, and, you know, they're, you can sort of forgive that they didn't go for the physical comedy in favor of things like this, because it is a genre film.
You start to think that as their relationship begins to develop, that the business is going to flounder because now Freddie has to play a more pivotal role. But Freddie actually kind of does the opposite. You know, he makes bad business deals in the beginning, but the more leadership he takes, like he gets them into this political event with the president of the United States because he sees it as a networking opportunity. Like, he's still a clown, but in the back of his head, he's still trying to make connections to build the businesses. The whole thing with lying about Alan being a Vietnam vet was because he was going to get them exclusivity for an entire grocery chain. Like, he's still thinking big. And it's kind of a surprise at times that Alan didn't think to do that, but I like that they didn't just make Freddy the dumb sidekick.
I agree, and I also like that they didn't go for a breakdown between the two of them, and Freddy's just being completely supportive of this relationship. He's not holding anything against Alan for not being there. Like, right. He references, oh, you missed 2 days of work, but there's no anger there. There's no malice. And there's a little bit of character growth for Freddie too, because now given the chance and, you know, out of necessity for him stepping up, he's really succeeding at this. So I like it for both of them. And I like that they didn't, you know, go the obvious route of them having a fight and now Alan questioning his relationship and should I really get involved and maybe I should go back to the business, and Freddie, you can go back to doing what you were doing. I feel like that all just would have been so obvious. So I like that they subvert expectations here. The only thing that I wish is that we had a little bit more context as to why Madison only has these 6 days. I like the time constraint because it does raise the stakes on the relationship. It does force Alan to decide, you know, am I going to commit to her? And for him to be more forthcoming about his feelings. But I feel like we just sort of, I don't know. I mean, maybe I am asking too much because we're talking about a movie about a mermaid, you know?
Well, not necessarily, though, because she references when the moon is full and I can't go back. So what we kind of never learn is it that she can't go back because once she has legs for 7 days, they don't come back? Or is it that she dies? Because by the end of the film, she's dying in that tank and they have to get her back to salt water. And even when she jumps in the bathtub at his house, she puts the table salt in the water. So you don't know if it's a permanent thing or if it's a death thing. Like, they never define what happens at the end of that week.
If I had to venture a guess, I would say that it results in death, because I do believe that while this isn't directly adapted from Hans Christian Andersen, it was a big inspiration for this story. And, you know, as we all know, that Little Mermaid is a lot darker than the Disney-fied animation one that we got. But I also think that that's why, you know, we do sort of get our answer within the context of the film because he goes with her.
Right. Right. And that she doesn't stay on land.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at any rate, moving on, I like the scene in the park where they see the fountain. I like that he says they're going to tear this park down. And she's like, why? And he's like, oh, they're just going to build high rises on it. It's a very New York thing to do. And they continue to do that now. So I like that they kind of, like, they call it to attention and they put them on the carpet 40 years ago. Learn nothing, of course. But the thing here is that I feel like they use it as a plot device to get the fountain in his apartment for two reasons. Number one, they want the visual comedy of this fountain sitting in the middle of an apartment where it doesn't belong. And for that moment where they tell each other that they love each other, even though he doesn't want to say it at first, even though he really does love her, but he doesn't want to say it, so you don't know if he's got a commitment issue, which kind of goes back to how I started my conversation about him in the beginning with Victoria. There's something about this, though, that I dislike. He's like, where's your necklace? I traded it for the fountain because I love you. What necklace? You know, until they pointed out that her necklace was gone, I didn't even realize that she had one.
Oh, really?
No, I never even realized that she had one.
I think it's very prominent from the time that she's a kid.
I don't think that they put enough stake into the necklace because it doesn't come off as the thoughtful gesture.
Sean, she doesn't even have clothes. It's the only thing that she owns.
Other than her fin.
That's all she knows how to do. This is how she... Because let's not forget, he gave her the music box at this point, which, by the way, that is, I want to see them dancing in Part of Your World. I think they drew it to look like this on purpose. I think they were being self-referential with it. So she wants to return that gesture because he got her a gift. This is, you know, she doesn't have money. Even though she got all of the clothes, so I'm going to go out on the limb and say that she's got one of his credit cards. But, like, to her, she gave up the only thing that's hers, the only thing that she owns. I mean, she's already given up everything about herself to just be with him. And she wants to do even more because he gave her a gift. She wants to return the favor. So I actually really like that, knowing it's the only thing that she has, she's willing to trade it for him. And it's that's really the driving force of their relationship the entire thing, is just she is giving up everything.
It's not the gesture that I have an issue with. It's that I feel like that they just don't emphasize the necklace.
No, I get it. And I know you understand the gesture. I'm just saying it is the only thing that she has. So, you know, she's naked. Like, how much more do you need them to draw attention to it?
Well, because I think maybe in retrospect, they draw too much comedy on her being naked. I think it becomes distracting that she's naked when she comes on land the first time, because you get the creepy guys that are trying to take pictures of her. You have the police that are coming to cover her up. You got the dad that throws his kid off the binoculars at the Statue of Liberty to get a better look. Like, it all plays well for comedy, but I feel like because you do all that for comedy, you lose the fact that the only thing she has is the necklace.
And to be fair, they do bury it under all her new clothes.
Yes.
So I'll give you that one. I will give you that one.
But as this character is developing, as their relationship is developing, so is unhinged Kornbluth. So is unhinged Eugene Levy, who has come back to New York. He wants to show everybody that the mermaid exists. And the more unhinged he gets, the funnier the character gets. And this character is like one beat away from being over the top, but they never push him that far. They take him just to the brink of being a cartoon character. And they had the restraint. And they never pushed him that far. And that's why that character works so well.
Yeah, restraint is the operative word. It's perfect.
So let's talk about the dinner that they go to, where she starts eating the lobster with her bare hands and just bites through the shell.
This is hard to watch, honestly. I'm like, ow.
but it's hysterical.
It is. It's good. It's all really well done.
It's well done, and it plays to the character because she's like, oh, this is just how we eat lobster where I'm from. Because Alan still does not know the secret. He just keeps assuming, and this whole thing is funny, he keeps thinking she's from another country and that she's got an immigration status that's going to expire. And this is where he starts talking about, well, let's get married, let's get married. We'll marry you for the green card. We'll go get a blood test, and we can be married by tomorrow. Like, this whole thing starts to turn him a little unhinged, but I think they planted it at the right time.
I agree, because now, you know, he's done a full 180. He's a commitment phobe. He's really fallen for her. He's ready to do what he needs to do to stay with her, even though at this point her gestures have been a lot bigger. I really like the fallout from the proposal. You know, and then you've got this sort of montage where he's looking for her. He's chasing her down. And there's that one shot where they're on the same bridge. She obviously has to stay out of the water because if she gets wet, she's going to get stranded. Her fins come back.
Right.
So she's just under this bridge. She's got to stay there to stay dry. And he's on top of it. He's right there. They're in the same place. So there's just something like kind of beautifully tragic about it.
And the really impressive thing about this entire scene is that he is understandably upset that she refuses to marry him, won't tell him why. She starts coming off inadvertently like a free spirit. And that's upsetting him because he's like, well, what are we doing here? Why are we even wasting our time? You understand why he's upset. You sympathize for him. You sympathize for how he feels. But you get angry at him for the way that he treats her. All at the same time. So not only is this incredibly, incredibly well written, it's incredibly well acted by Tom Hanks. The fact that you can sympathize with the character and yet dislike them at the same time, it sounds like it doesn't make sense. But when you sit and watch this and you know the scene, like, kudos to him. His performance is really, really good here.
See, I don't think that he becomes dislikable. To me, the only scene where he's truly dislikable is when she's in the bathroom and he's not respecting her privacy and he's trying to, like, break down the door. And she's answered him. She's not, you know, like, drowning in the tub where he needs to break the door down. She said, I'm good. Give her a minute, for crying out loud. Here, I don't think that he's dislikable because I think he needed that splash of cold water. He's finally fallen in love with someone and now he's had blinders on because now it's, well, wait, I really don't know anything about you. What is this secret that you're keeping from me? And you also need him a reason. You need to give him a reason to get mad when he finds out what it is. Because up until this point, it's like, I don't care. What could possibly be wrong? You're perfect. Everything's perfect. He's literally being blinded by love. And I feel like it wouldn't have been as convincing for him to be mad later that she kept this from him.
I like this political event scene with the president and with Kornbluth. Because the Secret Service believes that Kornbluth is pulling a gun on the president. That's
right.
What they think he's doing. Not realizing that he's got, basically, it's a water pistol. He's got the water tank. It's all so that he can spray Madison and get her soaking wet. And you have a moment where, as upset for Madison as you are, you kind of feel, I know this is going to sound weird, you feel good for Kornbluth because the whole time he's telling the truth and nobody believes him, and Eugene Levy, he delivers the line so well. It's so theatrical. Behold the mermaid! And the fin is flopping like a fish out of water on the sidewalk. And his eyes are so big and wide. It is such a great performance. And again, it's so cartoony, but you could just see the relief in him. That he's finally going to be vindicated.
No, it's brilliant because there's so much that he's channeling through that delivery. It's the relief, like you said, but I think there's also still a certain amount of disbelief that he actually pulled it off. And that it worked. Because what if it didn't? You know, he's already had quite a bit of comeuppance at this point. So yeah, you sort of have to give him the win. And then I love the turn that it takes for his character.
Yes.
After this, where he's really starting to regret what he's done to the person underneath. I sort of go back and forth with thinking that having the president involved was a little bit too over the top, but they actually did a good enough job of building to this. Like we talked about before, we know that they have money, but they even do a scene with the racquetball at the club. Like, and they say that
very
he's coming
80s.
To the club. It is very 80s, but they're establishing that, like, you know, they have money. So this wouldn't be completely out of the realm of possibility that they would end up in the same room as the president.
And you needed the press there.
And you need, to your point, the Secret Service, which was something that I hadn't even considered, because they think that there's going to be an attack on the president. And that's actually not what Kornbluth is after. So it does work. And I mean, for a film about a mermaid, like, you know, this is an easy place to suspend your disbelief.
The scene in the tank, every scene in the tank with her is a rough watch, because
so's the one of Tom Hanks. I am sorry.
Yeah.
Too much.
It's a lot. And we've had him
I'm
in there.
I'm not even going to make the cheap joke.
They when they go, he's been in there for 12 hours. He's clearly not a fish.
Oh no, I was going to say that this is later Woody.
Yeah, I knew the low-hanging fruit and you didn't go for it until you did. But the scene is rough because we know her as being someone that obviously swims around in the ocean, and now you're looking at her in a fish tank, but like a very small fish tank. And not to rehabilitate her, she starts to deteriorate. She starts to turn pale. Her fin starts to flake and peel.
And like the algae, like every kid had a fish, and one day you let it go too far where you needed to clean the tank. But like to see a person like this, the algae, though, it was really well done.
Really well done. And that's where you see the turn for Kornbluth, because the other scientists are saying that they're basically going to dismember her to study her. And that's when he realizes what he's done is wrong. I wish in that moment he would have pursued Alan. Instead, Alan pursues him, again, for comedy at the dentist office. And
yeah,
he has that line of, I don't deserve Novocaine, you know, for all the things that I've done. So you obviously regret what you've done. I wish that he would have taken the initiative to go to Alan.
I agree, because what I also don't like here is Alan's attitude. He's not even in disbelief that she's a mermaid. He goes straight to, woe is me. I finally found love. And it's not working out again. And it takes forever to dawn on him that, like, this is not about you right now. You need to help her. Where this is really successful, though, is having an unhinged brother like Freddy. Because
yes,
there are no questions asked. He's just going to handle this however he needs to. Faking being Swedish.
Swedish candy.
Which is great. It's so funny. And then he's the plant at the end when they finally get her out, when they do the old switcheroo.
Yeah.
This is maybe one of my favorite John Candy moments ever.
Yeah. And when he learns to speak Swedish, not well, obviously, when you know the line that he says, and they go, how'd you do that? He's like, well, a lot of the really good dirty films are filmed overseas. And when you've seen them a few hundred times, you start to learn the language. John Candy, I don't want to say celebrated, because that's not, you don't celebrate it, but the 30th anniversary of his passing was just a few days ago. And God, I miss John Candy. You want to talk about somebody that was taken from this world far too young. There's so much that he left on the table. And he was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant. And this is one of, I think, one of his more forgotten roles.
I would agree with you. To circle back to what you said, though, about the dirty movies, that actually might be the thing that makes the film feel the most dated. Because if you think about how people consume those types of things now, you can get it anywhere.
I know.
But funny nonetheless. That's still, it's dated, but it still holds.
The best line in the movie, and a line that I would print on a t-shirt and wear at least once a week, after they get Madison out of the tank. They have her wrapped in a cloth so that nobody can see who she is. They get her in the car. They take the cloth off. She sees Alan and she sees Kornbluth, and Alan explains to her, no, it's okay. He's here to help. We just didn't like him at first. And Kornbluth says with a big smile on his face, no one likes me when they first meet me.
I'm dying to know if that was improvised.
It had to be.
It
had to be.
Because Eugene Levy was Second City, I believe. So,
and knew John Candy very well, and Rick Moranis, and he lived in that realm.
Yeah, I think they kind of gave him creative control over that. He's so brilliant. Like, from the moment they bust out of the door with the body, don't go in there. Like, yeah. This is where he really shines. All right, so now, you know, car chase through Manhattan. We get to the harbor, and Alan's got to make a choice. And I like that it all comes down to him, because like we talked about, Madison has been the aggressor the entire time. She's been the pursuer. She has been the one to sacrifice everything. So now the shoe is on the other foot, and he has a decision to make, because clearly, even if she could physically stay there, if they figure that out, she's never going to have her freedom. You know, they've established they're going to keep coming after her no matter what. And eventually they'll capture her and they're going to do more experiments. So the only choice is that he's got to go. Let me ask you something, though. Do you think the only reason that he chooses her, because he was about to let her go, do you think it was because she confirmed that it was her as a kid?
No, I think he went with her because I think that he knew that that was the person he was supposed to be with. I think that through all the commitment issues that he has throughout the entire film, I think that's why he did it. Because she could have just as easily escaped the authorities without his help. I mean, he did very little to help her anyway.
Right.
It was a second set of hands to fight them off, the National Guard, when they were diving in after her. But she could have done that on her own. I think that they wanted to take the happy ending that we thought we were getting, and they wanted to turn it on its head. So I think that it worked. I think it was good nonetheless. I thought it was interesting that it would appear that I think, find the lost city of Atlantis, I think is kind of what they were implying that we were swimming off to. I think that it's interesting that by her kissing him, now he can breathe under the water and swim. That was a little far-fetched. For a movie about a mermaid in Manhattan, it was a little far-fetched.
Oh, to me, the most unbelievable thing about this entire movie is that, okay, I understand you want to utilize filming in the Bahamas, and especially now that I know that they purchased land there, so you're going to get your money's worth. But the most unbelievable thing is that she dove in to the East River in Manhattan, and there's coral there.
Yeah.
Those should be mounds of garbage and bodies.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly what it would be. Even then, and even worse so now. But be that as it may. Let's talk about our cast here, starting with Tom Hanks. Very early role for him. In fact, the studio initially did not greenlight him. They did not want him. They offered the role to Bill Murray, who turned it down because he wanted to get away from comedies. Now, the funny thing is that this came out in 84, so this came out the same year as Ghostbusters did. But he was trying to transition into more serious roles, and I think into, like, dark comedy, because then he did things like Scrooged and What About Bob? So they were all comedy, but not in the same vein. But they wanted him. They wanted Chevy Chase. But I think they eventually hit the home run getting Tom Hanks in this role. I think that he's endearing for the most part. Frustrating at times, but not his fault. I think that at times that the character is a little frustrating. I think that's how he was written. But still kind of your ordinary everyday man. Lives a very nice lifestyle, but doesn't flaunt it. So I really liked him in the role.
I do too. I love Tom Hanks in a comedy because I didn't watch his earlier stuff. I came in at the, well, no, I came in really at the rom-coms, but like I'm more of the Tom Hanks Sleepless in Seattle or the Catch Me If You Can and the Castaway, like the more dramatic roles, the Sully, the Miracle on the Hudson.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm most familiar with. But I love him in comedies. I thought he was great in this. And I think, you know, that's the other thing is having an actor like him that can handle the drama. He's got that emotional gravitas when you need it here, where, you know, he's got to wrestle with the fact of, you know, what did I just do with this mermaid? Is it illegal? Like, you know, and yet I still love her. And can I pursue this? Is there a way for us to be together? You know, he's able to carry all of those subtleties in this performance.
Yeah. And I think that Daryl Hannah was great. She's endearing. She's fun. She's innocent. Again, a fairly unknown actress at the time. Diane Lane had been offered the role. She turned it down. The funny thing was Ron Howard, they almost didn't make the movie, but Ron Howard and Brian Grazer had to like get the movie under budget, so to speak, to get the movie made. And that was the other reason why
the island,
they hadn't purchased the island yet. That wasn't for 13 years after.
Got it.
But they didn't purchase it. They don't even own it. They just leased it. They wanted to get the film under budget to get the film made to push it for the green light. So it's funny that Disney, I mean, I get it for Touchstone. It's the first film under this new banner that they want the film made cheaply, but you wanted Diane Lane and Bill Murray.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, I thought Daryl Hannah was excellent.
I would agree. And what's really remarkable too, is that she said at this point, you know, she really had never even had a boyfriend. And now this is one of her first films. She's got to kiss and like kiss a lot. There's a lot of kissing scenes. So I can only imagine between that and then having to do the mermaid fins and all of the swimming. Like, this was a really challenging first crack at it.
For sure. John Candy. He's perfection. I don't have anything else to add. John Candy is Freddy.
No, we would be here all day. I sort of love to live in a world where this is like Del Griffith's origin story for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, because now, you know, we know that the parents are gone. We know that Alan has left him. Alan's talking about, well, maybe I can come and visit for Christmas. And Madison says it doesn't work like that. He can never go back. So Freddy's going to be all alone now. So maybe he decides to try and find love. And then loses his wife. I mean, the setup, it's all there.
And that would explain why he's in Manhattan trying to leave to go back to Chicago with the curtain rings.
The location even works. Yeah, and he's without Alan, he's squandered the business.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe that's what's funding him living on the road, because he doesn't have Marie and he doesn't want to go home. So he took that and he bankrolled it into just traveling the world. There might be a connection here.
There might be.
The timeline doesn't work, but we're willing to ignore that because we're willing to believe that a mermaid is in Manhattan. Just like we're willing to believe that Eugene Levy is a scientist. But he pulls it off. Kornbluth, hysterical. Eugene Levy, hysterical. Absolute perfect, perfect casting in this role.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite roles of his. He's incredible.
Final thoughts on Splash. I'll let you go first.
I've got to be honest, I was kind of all over the map with this one because I really hadn't remembered my first viewing of it. And, you know, there wasn't a big takeaway from that. So watching it now with fresh eyes, I really liked all of the parallels to Little Mermaid, but they're all the opposite choices. You know, like, yes, Ariel and Madison both go to land, but Ariel trades in her voice. Madison finds her voice. You know, Ariel chooses to stay on land with Eric. Alan chooses Madison. So I like that they take what we know, even though this was before Little Mermaid, the animated film. Everybody knows the story. So I like that they flipped it on its head. And I think that this was a really smart way to do that adaptation. But after watching it, in preparation for our review, there were a couple of things that I sort of bumped on, and there were a couple of things with like story structure that I didn't like and the dated references. I kind of thought like this is Splash. Like this is this iconic movie. This is one of the things that contributed to saving this company. And I just didn't think it was that great of a movie, if I'm being totally honest. But sitting here talking through it with you, I actually enjoyed it a lot more than I did watching it.
Interesting. I mean, I honestly grade it as near perfect.
Whoa, okay.
I'm not going to give it a perfect score because there are a handful of little things that I feel like could have been tinkered with, could have been adjusted, but it's pretty damn close. And I think maybe there's a part of me that's a little biased because I love the cast, because I love practical effects, because I love sets, because I love an original story. They wouldn't make this movie today.
No.
Oh, no. In fact, they're making a sequel. They're developing a sequel to this.
Stop it.
With Jillian Bell, who we love, and Channing Tatum, who we also love.
Oh, okay.
But you know it's going to be a CGI nightmare. It's not,
yeah.
It's not going to be this. And that's the thing. It's not going to be this. So whether or not that film gets off the ground, I don't know. But they're currently developing it.
But like what? How? Are they their kids? Like, is this...
This is supposed to be before.
It's not a remake. Okay.
It's supposed to be before everything happens. I don't know if these are Madison's parents, but apparently this is a prequel before Madison even comes to Manhattan. But with that being said, I give it a near perfect score. I do think that it's well-paced. I think the characters are great. I think the comedy, for the most part, lands. I do love that trip down memory lane, the nostalgia. Do I think that this was the right means to send Touchstone, you know, into orbit? I think that it was. I think that they had a surprise hit on their hands. Did that mean that the Disney animators should have been kicked off the lot? No. But obviously they wanted their stable for their A-list actors and they wanted nicer amenities for them. Could they have done something else? Yes, but...
Trailers.
But with all of that being said, I do think that this movie is something that, while some of the references are dated, I think the movie holds up, and I think it's something that if you watch it now, you'll enjoy. But we're interested in knowing what you have to say about Splash. You can join the conversation on social media at Monoreal Radio on all major platforms, or you can send us an email, monorealradio@gmail.com. News of the Week is coming up, but first, a quick break.
News of the Week is proudly sponsored by KMV Travel. KMV Travel is a boutique travel agency that helps families plan personalized vacations and create unforgettable memories on land and at sea. If you've dreamed of setting sail on the Disney fleet, KMV Travel will help you from booking to bon voyage. When you connect with a KMV Travel specialist, they will not only assist you with your cruise package, but they will also help you with your stateroom selection, pre- and post-cruise accommodations, ground transportation, onboard activity reservations, and port activity reservations. Whether you are traveling as a couple, with a family, or a large group, your KMV Travel advisor will help you customize the perfect cruise itinerary for you. Visit KMV Travel to set sail now.
Hey guys, my name is Mike. I listen to Jackie and Sean's podcast every week on my commute into work. So I reached out to Jackie and she helped me put together the perfect getaway. I did a 4-night Disney cruise ship and she was able to answer every question that I threw at her. She put together the perfect dates and an insurance plan that made the whole experience stress-free. She was able to help me with little tips and tricks, like you can get a Mickey Mouse bar delivered to you any time of the day. And I think that was a mistake because now I put about 10-15 pounds on. I'll definitely be using Jackie again in the future. Thanks for everything.
Let's talk about original concepts. Let's talk about original films. Let's talk about Marvel fatigue, or the lack thereof, according to Bob Iger. This is really interesting. Morgan Stanley hosted a panel with Bob Iger. It was a talk that they had. And Bob Iger confirmed that they have recently killed projects.
Quietly.
Quietly. They did not confirm which ones they killed.
But we can only hope for Snow White.
I hope Snow White is one of them. a lot of people online are speculating that it is a lot of Marvel. Things that were supposed to be series on Disney Plus that we didn't hear about anymore. Films that got announced, but we never heard about them going into production. I don't want to speculate on what it is, but all I know is that he said that these are difficult decisions that got made because they had already sunk money and resources into it. And his words were, "And it's tough to kill things when you don't believe in them anymore."
Wow.
So, it seems like there are projects that are gone. This is a cost-cutting measure, obviously. He still thinks that we're going to have a really solid year in 2024 because of Deadpool and because of the new Planet of the Apes film. Now, I think that those are two good examples of films that can do well because you haven't beaten Planet of the Apes to death. And because Deadpool is Marvel, but it's so unique and so different, and you space the sequels out, that I think that those are two films that are going to do well for Disney this year.
I would agree. I mean, I don't think that anyone should necessarily be surprised by this news, because if you think about the timing, they did just announce Moana 2, and we know that that was in development, or I would venture a guess that it was in production for the Disney Plus series, and they decided to pivot. So my guess is that that was part of the bigger conversation they had about these projects and determining what they were going to keep and what they were going to kill. You'll also notice that all of a sudden we got our first look at Tron. So they're like really leaning heavy into that now. So I think that that's something to be aware of is, you know, look at what they're holding up to give us like the bright and shiny things to focus on. And that's going to, I think, clue us in as to what's no longer there or what was announced that they're no longer doing. My guess is, you know, Frozen 3 and 4, I'm thinking they're safe. I don't think that you can touch that. They're still running pretty hot with Frozen right now. I think what he's referencing by saying, you know, it's tough to kill these projects when we've already sunk money into them, I think that that is absolutely Snow White, because it's been promoted. You know, photos have been released. They were getting ready to release this film. So I think that that's one of the ones where they're just cutting the loss, because it's never going to recoup what they spent on it at the box office. And, you know, I mean, let's not forget, when they do things like this, we're talking about writing it off. Some of these films can be credited as a tax write-off. Like Warner Brothers just did it with the Wile E. Coyote movie that's never going to see the light of day.
Right.
Which would have been like a modern day Who Framed Roger Rabbit. People are pounding the table for it. And Warner Brothers is like, nope, we're just going to delete it. Netflix tried to buy it. There was so much popularity surrounding the premise because everybody was excited for what now? A new concept, even though it was an IP. You know, you're taking that same structure that worked with Roger Rabbit of, you know, turning Wile E. Coyote into a working actor that's been hurt, and now he wants to
sue, right?
It he wants to take legal action. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Brilliant. It's brilliant. That's how you repurpose these characters that are going to make people want to go see them again. Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. Reeling it back into Disney. I think we're going to be able, within the next couple of months, we're going to be able to tell what projects have been canceled.
Bob Iger was also asked if he thinks that people are suffering from Marvel fatigue, and he says no. And I think because he can't possibly sit there and say yes and say, yeah, it's too, even though he kind of has said that previously, that they did too many sequels, they rushed too many things. But he goes, people like great films. There's a reason why all of these films that Marvel did made billions and billions and billions, right? Because they were building towards the Infinity Saga. Now that it's over, I think they were still trying to push Marvel where people were fatigued by Marvel. And then he goes, people want great films. Look at Oppenheimer. That was great. Yeah, Oppenheimer was also not Marvel. You didn't have Iron Man. Well, no, you had Iron Man in it, but he wasn't playing Iron Man. I thought that that was a horrific example.
Yeah.
You're taking a film that could win Best Picture And you're saying, well, they like that. That's like saying they like Gone with the Wind, so let's make another Captain America movie.
A better comparison would have been Barbie, because that is an IP, but look what they did with it.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of... This is just him talking out of both sides of his mouth.
He's protecting his assets. I kind of get it. But we are interested in knowing what you have to say about all of this Disney news. You can let us know on all major social media platforms at Monoreal Radio, or you can shoot us an email, monorealradio@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for joining us this and every week on Monoreal Radio. Monoreal Radio will always be free, but there are many ways that you can help support the show. Please give us a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join the conversation on social media at Monoreal Radio on all major platforms. Share your favorite episodes with family and friends who may enjoy them. And of course, book your next trip with Jackie. Links to everything can be found at monorealradio.com. We all get one story. Make yours a magical one.
On behalf of Monoreal Radio, we'd like to thank you for joining us. We'll see you at the movies, the stuff dreams are made of.